Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. In this episode, we will be discussing the rentier economy and the ways in which it can threaten economic dynamism and growth. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Professor Brett Christophers. Professor Christophers is a professor of social and economic geography at Sweden's Uppsala University. He is the author of an excellent book, Rentier Capitalism: Who Owns the Economy and Who Pays for It? A book that details the ways in which Western economies have harnessed financialization to implement rent-seeking strategies to extract greater wealth from all sectors of the economy. This is what we will get into today. Professor Christophers, welcome to the show.
Hi, Edward. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for taking the time. We're very happy to have you on the show today. We are going to be talking about renterism and the effects it has on society. So to get things started, can you explain to our listeners what exactly is rentier capitalism? Why should we be concerned with it? And perhaps what led you to write about this topic?
Okay, so there's quite a few questions there, and I'll try and get to all of them. I think probably the best way to answer that is to go in reverse order. So, because I think that the question of how I got into the topic is actually quite meaningful and helps me answer the other parts of the question. So, I had the book that I wrote prior to this one was a book called The New Enclosure, which was a book about a process that's been going on in the United Kingdom for the last three or four decades, which has been a process of privatization of publicly owned land. And so essentially what's been happening is that a lot of the land owned by public sector bodies in the UK, whether that's in central government or local government, has been sold off to the private sector, in particular since the 1970s. And one of the results of that, I wrote about that in that book, was that there's been the emergence of a very large cohort of essentially property companies who have acquired that land from public bodies and now make very large amounts of money by essentially owning and renting out that land to people and institutions that want to use that land. And so those entities are what we would traditionally think of as rentiers. So in classical political economy, land rent was the classic form of rent, where you have a landlord and you have a tenant of some form. And so I saw this going on in the UK. But what also kind of occurred to me while I was working on that book and thinking about the UK economy more generally was that essentially, you see pretty much the same sort of thing, the same kind of underlying economic dynamic occurring in other sectors of the economy. So it's not just about land. So if you think about what's going on with land as an actor owning a proprietary asset of some form and earning money by making that asset available to other actors to use it or access it in some way, then that's a generic form of rent. And what I realize is that the more you look at the UK economy, the more you see precisely the same dynamics occurring in other parts of the economy as well, whether that's in terms of financial assets or intellectual property assets or digital platform assets. And we can come back to those different forms later. So what I started doing was trying to think about the UK economy in this more broadly, beyond just land and housing, in terms of this rentier dynamic. And that's what I refer to as rentier capitalism. It's certainly not just me that does that. It's a term that's been, you know, increasingly widely invoked in recent years by others as well. But basically, if you think about rent as this, as a form of income that flows as a result of proprietary ownership of some valuable asset of some kind. And if you think about a rentier as the person or institution that earns that rent, then essentially rentier capitalism is a form of capitalism where that type of income and that type of economic actor is very, very prominent.
In the book, you talk about how Marx was baffled by the fact that the landed rentier was still in existence by the 19th century, and you also talk about how Keynes in the 20th century believed that financial rentierism would eventually dissipate. What was their thinking, and why have we seen such a greater reliance on renterism in corporate profit making?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And you're right. So both of those thinkers, both of those writers were very sort of anti-rentier, I guess is one way of putting it. I mean, Marx obviously was anti a lot of other stuff as well. But Keynes in particular, you know, while he certainly amongst all the kind of actors in the capitalist drama, it was rentiers, in particular financial rentiers, that he was most critical of. But for both of them, really, the continued existence of rentierism and the continued kind of economic profitability of rentier actors didn't really make sense to them, because for both of them, they basically thought that those actors weren't really contributing very much. They were kind of resting on their laurels, enjoying the fact that they had this monopolistic ownership, and we'll come back maybe later to talk about monopoly, had this kind of proprietary ownership of assets, but they weren't really doing very much. And it didn't really make sense, particularly to Marx. He was like, well, why, you know, now we're in this brave new world of industrial capitalism where we have these factories and we have these industrial capitalists earning lots of money. Why are industrial capitalists sharing some of the profit with landowners? And as Keynes later put it, why are the same industrial capitalists sharing some of that profit with financiers in the form of land rent in the first case, and in the form of interest on capital in the second case? So both of them kind of thought these dynamics would, or either should have already died out, or at least would die out as capital and capitalism became more rational over time. And so the question of the fluctuating historical fortunes of rentiers is a very, very important one. And I think that, you know, the main answer I give in the book to that question about why it has kind of been maintained, why it's continued, comes down a lot to policy. You know, if you read in particular Piketty's work in the book that made him well known, The Capital in the 21st Century, but he makes this point, which is that rentier fortunes have fluctuated significantly historically. And he also makes the point that, which it's entirely correct, that those fortunes have fluctuated in response to changing economic policies, particularly around things like ownership, around taxation, and around regulation. So private sector rentiers can only make significant economic fortunes, earn lots of money, if there are significant sets of assets within the private sector for them to own. So at particular times when there's been greater levels of public ownership of assets, like land, for example, but not only land, private sector rentiers haven't done so well. In the second case, when there have been periods when there have been much higher levels of taxation on assets, such as land, but not only land, again, rentiers haven't done so well. And that's the thing that obviously that Piketty focuses on most of all, is higher levels of taxation of property and other forms of wealth between the 1920s and 1970s. And then last of all, in periods when there's been much more stringent regulation of rentier owners of assets, they haven't done so well either. So if you go back to, say, the 1950s and 1960s in the UK, the financial sector was nowhere near as profitable as it would later become. And one of the reasons for that was there was very tight forms of regulation on, you know, where in the economy money should be lent, how much could be lent, under what terms, and so on. And it was only when all that regulation was essentially stripped away in the 1980s that the finance sector again within the UK came to the fore. So you have this kind of historical almost kind of concertina movement where you have periods of great rentier success, and then rentier fortunes get subdued according to policies around ownership, taxation, and regulation. But then again, once again, since the 1980s, the rentier has kind of again come to the fore because of very accommodating and very supportive policy in all of these areas.
So what is your, I guess, estimation of the proportion of corporate profits that are dedicated to rentierism today versus what was witnessed in the, I guess, mid 20th century? You know, did rentierism decline in the mid to late 20th century to then be revived in the current century? And if so, what brought about that change?
Yeah, so I've already sort of hinted at what those changes were. I mean, I think that's right in terms of the timeline. You know, as Piketty said, it was really from the period of the two world wars and through to the 1970s that rentierism was kind of dampened, and rentier fortunes were not as strong as they had been previously. And then it's really since the 1970s, so from the 1980s onwards, that rentier fortunes have been revived across the board, certainly within Western countries, I would say. Now, the question of kind of putting numbers on that, putting proportions on that is very, very difficult. Yep. And I think that the reasons for that are actually quite revealing. So one thing is to say is that all of this varies hugely by country. So, you know, in the book that I wrote that we're talking about, the primary empirical focus is on the UK, and I think it would be hard to think of a country that has been more kind of friendly to rentier interest in recent decades than the UK for all sorts of different reasons. Not least of which is that privatization of formerly publicly owned assets has kind of gone further there than almost anywhere else I can think of. So there's just more assets in the private sector for rentiers to earn rents on. You know, in many ways, maybe surprisingly, the US has gone much less far down that route. You know, lots of forms of kind of infrastructure that are wholly in private hands in the UK are still within public hands, whether federal or municipal within the US, which means that there aren't as many assets for rentiers to kind of sweat and earn fortunes on in the US as in the UK, ironically, in some
ways. That's surprising, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that does surprise a lot of people. So privatization has never gone as far in the US or as broadly as it has in the UK. I think the other thing to say is that, you know, you can't just open a set of national accounts and kind of read down the table and see a line for rentier income. It doesn't work like that. You know, if you look at the line for rent, that's in the national accounts. That's a very specific form of rent. You know, it's rent earned by property companies. And so all of the different forms of income that I'm talking about in terms of a very different concept of rent, which is any type of income earned by virtue of control of a proprietary asset of some type, there isn't a measure for that. So you have to kind of come up with them.
Right.
And even that's not very straightforward, right? Because I think this is a really important point, which is that, you know, there aren't many capitalist firms whose income doesn't contain rentier elements,
right,
of some degree or another. So it isn't like the way I would explain it is not that you like have rentiers here, who all of whose income takes the form of what we're calling rent, and non-rentiers over there who don't earn any income that is rent. That's not really how it works. It's a much more kind of fluid concept than that. I think the way to think about it is that some corporations are of a much more rentier type nature than others. That's the way to think about it. And so I tend not to try to put specific figures on it, but what I do in the book is I say, well, look, the sectors of the economy that are decisively rentierist in nature, property, finance, pharmaceuticals, for example, you know, thoroughly based upon proprietary ownership of intellectual property of various forms. Those sectors have become much more significant parts of Western economies generally, and of the UK economy particularly in recent decades. So that's the kind of as far as I go in terms of kind of trying to quantify it. The other way I do it is to say, look at the 30 or 50 or even 100 biggest companies on the FTSE 100, for example. And what you see is that pretty much all of them are rentier companies of one type or another, being dominant in, you know, natural resource rents or intellectual property rents or financial rents or whatever else it might be. So does that answer your question?
Oh, yes, yes. So you touched on the sectors that you feel or that you've studied to be the most rentier. What has been rentier capitalism's effect on economic dynamism and innovation? I would imagine that it's been probably quite detrimental.
Yes, is the short answer to that. I think the longer answer to that, or at least slightly longer answer to that, would be that it's important not to be sort of overly simplistic and overly kind of unnuanced about this. You know, there are certain types of assets that rentier type firms earn income on that certainly required a degree of dynamism, a degree of an innovative activity to develop them in the first place. You know, again, pharmaceutical patents, for example, right. Some of those would be very, very good examples. But, and here's the big but, I think that the two kind of big counteracting arguments to that. One is that policy has been introduced or changed to a significant extent in recent decades that has encouraged corporations to sit on existing assets and sweat those assets and try to extend the lifetime of those existing assets through things like patent extensions and evergreening of other types of assets, rather than developing new assets that they might then be able to earn rents on. And I think that's been a wholly negative development. And so policy has, and obviously it's not surprising because rentiers are big lobbyists,
right?
The pharmaceutical sector or whether it's the oil and gas sector. And they have helped to shape those policies that have in turn encouraged them to sit on those existing assets and earn rents from those existing assets without having to go through the hard work and expensive work of developing new assets. So that's one thing. I think policy has encouraged a lack of dynamism in that regard. I think the other one is that, you know, in a lot of cases, rent generating assets are assets that require no innovation or dynamism to develop in the first place. You know, think about, for example, all the companies that own the big infrastructure networks in a country like the UK, whether that's in water or telecoms or in energy. Those assets were given to them through privatization, often at knockdown prices. They didn't need to do anything to develop those assets in the first place. They were handed them, same with land, through land privatization in the UK, as per that previous book. And so a lot of these assets required no innovative or dynamic activity to develop in the first place. So on balance, I would say absolutely the impact has been a negative impact on economic dynamism and innovation.
I would assume that the rentier mode of profit maximization intertwines quite well with monopoly power. Is rentier capitalism something that can really only thrive through some form of monopoly power?
That's a great question. So, you know, you and for sure your listeners will be very aware that there's been a whole burst of writing about growth in monopoly power within Western economies, not least the US economy, in recent times. You know, the work of people like Matt Stoller and others have written a lot about this. What I try to do in the book is make the argument that rentierism and rentier capitalism are very much bound up with monopoly power, but they're not the same thing. And I think it's important to try to sort of distinguish between what we're talking about. So on the one hand, I think it's plainly the fact that you can have monopoly or oligopoly power in the absence of what you might call rent generating assets of the type that we've been talking about. So, you know, I think back to the 1960s and 1950s in the UK, for example, and manufacturing industry was highly cartelized. So you had these price fixing cartels that enjoyed, by virtue of those cartels, significant monopoly or at least oligopoly power. But that wasn't about rent generating assets. It was simply about industry organization, industry structure. There might have been some rent generating assets involved, but that wasn't what the monopoly power was principally about. So you can have monopoly power without rent generating assets. Looking at it from the other way, I would say that rent generating assets are only able really to generate rent for their owners because of monopoly power in one way or another. So the first thing to think about is that you almost, I guess almost always, if not always, have this involves monopolistic control of those assets. Their owners are only able to capture the rents that those assets generate precisely because they have monopolistic control of them in the first place. That's one thing. And I think the second thing is that these assets tend to grant market monopolies in one way or another. So think, for example, about trying to think of an example. So one of the examples I write about a lot in the book is about the oil and gas sector, and in particular about the oil and gas sector in the North Sea of the UK through the 1980s onwards, which has obviously been a harvest for rentiers of different national origins. Now, the assets the likes of BP and Shell and others have enjoyed in recent decades, coming, you know, there are various forms, but the natural resource could only become a valuable asset for those companies because they were granted licenses over particular tracts of the North Sea that were monopolistic licenses. Right. So I guess what I'm getting at there is that kind of monopoly is in various ways inherent in these rent generating assets. If monopoly wasn't part and parcel of those assets, they wouldn't be able to generate rent for their owners.
Right. Professor, you say in the book, quote, "When you hear corporate executives wax lyrical about the strength and health of a company's balance sheet, about leveraging it, using it efficiently, and putting it to work, it is as sure a sign as any that that company is a rentier capitalist." Professor, it seems that this is precisely what dominates earnings calls these days. The notion of executives finding ways to extract greater profits by having rather than doing, in a sense, using their power to increase prices rather than increase production and placement of their products. Have we, in a sense, all become rentiers?
Oh, that's a that's a good question. I think it's also a sort of sensitive question in a way. Two things that come to mind there. Two very different things, actually. So the first of them is interesting. It was really interesting to hear you talk about earnings calls as a sort of window onto the real nature of capitalism. Because I totally agree with that. And I think one of the things that's very interesting that I'm sure a lot of people have, you know, certainly not just myself, have noticed is that when corporate executives talk to analysts on earnings calls, they say very, very different things than when they talk to, say, politicians or the media. And so if it's in terms of things like in terms of the types of issues we've been talking about in relation to rentier capitalism, what you'd often hear them saying to the media or politicians is, we're not powerful. We don't have we don't have exclusive control over these types of assets. We're not trying to use our power over these assets to push our prices. Then if you then listen to exactly the same people talking to analysts, they'll say, the reason you, Mr. or Mrs. Analyst, should be buying stock in our company is that we do have this power.
Right.
we have power in the market. We have market power to set prices rather than take prices. We have, 20 years of exclusive rights to this or that particular asset. And so precisely the reason you should be investing in our company is that we are actual or effective monopolists.
Right.
And sometimes they overstate the case when they're talking to analysts because that's a marketing call as much as anything else. But you're always likely to hear things that are much closer to the truth when they talk to analysts than when they talk to politicians in the media. And so absolutely that's true. The point about whether we're all rentiers now, I think the reason that's a very good question and a very sensitive question is that, as I say in the book, if you look at financial assets and property assets in particular, it's less the case with the other types of assets I talk about in the book. But a very significant proportion of those assets, certainly in the UK, are owned by households rather than by companies. So most rental property in the UK still, at least residential rental property, if not commercial property, is owned by households, so kind of small-time buy-to-let investors. And then households are huge owners of financial assets, especially in the US, in their capacity as retirement savings individuals, so through pension plans of various forms. And so the uneasy situation is that one can be a principal critic of rentier capitalism while also being a rentier, insofar as one has pensions wealth. And so the first part of the answer to that question is we are all to a certain extent rentiers now, but no, in as much as A, not everybody has pensions wealth, and even if they do, some people have considerably more pensions wealth than others. And secondly, obviously not everyone owns property, never mind a second or third property that can be rented out. But, and I last point to make here is go back to, Piketty's book, which I love. One of the great things he argues, and he's completely right about this, is that we've gone from a situation in the late 19th century of what he calls a kind of hyper-patrimonial situation, where you had a small number of household or individual rentiers who owned huge amounts of property or financial wealth, to a situation today that is what he describes as merely patrimonial, where you have a much larger number of individuals and households in societies that own property and financial wealth, but typically they own much less, on average, much less financial or property wealth. But what that means is that the political economy of it, the economics of it, but also the politics of it, are very, very different today. When instead of having 1% of households that are rentiers, when you have 40 or 50% of households, right, that are what he calls petit rentiers.
Right. Yeah. What I found so shocking in recent years is the sheer volume of dialogue that is geared towards renting. If you walk down a personal finance section at your local bookstore, or take in any social media these days, you will find someone promoting the advantages of supplementing their income by becoming a rentier, but I believe that this is at least in part because people are now forced to supplement their income because jobs aren't paying enough and housing is so expensive. We've been put in a corner to house hack or find new income streams. So my question is, do you think that the spread of renterism at the corporate level has in any way forced individuals to become renters as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the, I mean, to start with the latter part of that question, I think the question had various components to it, but the latter of that part of that question, I'm not sure whether the connection in terms of causal terms between corporate renterism and individual renterism, but I think it's certainly the case that the growth in kind of what you might call household or individual rentership or renterism is clearly bound up with what's been happening in terms of labor markets, you know, declines or at least stagnation in real wages and so on. My mind's just gone back to a podcast I did on the book a year or more ago, where I was with some Dutch journalists, and one of the, and we were talking about the book, and we were talking about renterism, and one of the journalists said, look, you know, I'm going to confess that, you know, that my journalism is not the main source of income. My main source of income is I own a rental property
right here
in Amsterdam, he said, and I kind of need that to get by. And he looked at me over, and it was on Zoom, and he said, he looked at me through the screen. He said, does that make me a bad person? And my answer to him was, well, no, of course it doesn't. I mean, we're all trying to get by. And I think one of the really interesting things about the whole debate on rent and renterism is that it very often has kind of a moralistic or ethical inflection to it. You know, one of the main critiques of rent and renterism is a moralistic critique, which says rent is bad because it's unearned income insofar as the rentier hasn't done the kind of quote unquote hard work involved in
earning
that income. Right. And I totally get that critique, but my critique is I try to avoid that kind of moralistic critique and focus on a political economic critique, and one of the reasons for that, I think, is that I don't necessarily, first of all, I don't think it's necessarily a very helpful critique, but also, you know, if you think about it from the individual level or even the corporate level, renterism is kind of a rational response, I think, to an irrational set of structural incentives. You know, people in institutions have moved in the direction of rentier type activity because politicians have made it profitable to be rentiers.
Right. And I
always try and think about, you know, why companies and individuals do certain economic activities, and to focus on who and what it is that has created the, in this case, relatively warped incentives that have encouraged certain types of economic activity while discouraging certain other types of economic activity. And that goes back to all the stuff I was talking about earlier in terms of things like taxation, regulation, and so on and so forth. The world has moved, and countries like the UK in particular, have moved towards rentierism because the world has been structured in a way to make it profitable to do so.
Right, right. Well, when we think about Marx's argument that capitalism will sow the seeds of its own destruction, we recognize that argument is largely based on the rate of return earned by capital owners as it relates to economic growth and controlling for, you know, any impact of wealth transfers. But when we think about rentier capitalism and the fact that it consists almost entirely of maximizing the returns to capital by maximizing wealth extraction rather than producing the goods and services the economy needs, it sure does seem that rentier capitalism will, in one way or another, sow the seeds of its own destruction. Is that a reasonable conclusion, or do you think we we have enough wealth transfers and redistribution necessary to sort of keep the to keep it alive?
Oof, that's a big question. So, as I read him, Piketty's answer to that question is yes. So I think that's what he sees as kind of the logical outcome of the kind of inherent, what he sees as an inherent tendency towards rentierism within capitalism. And I think he argues implicitly, if not explicitly, that is essentially what kind of the world wars and the Great Depression were about, which is that capitalism becomes more and more rentierist, more and more structured towards privileged rentier interests, and accompanied by greater and greater levels of wealth equality until the elastic kind of snaps. That's Piketty's argument, is that I think he seems to feel that you only get kind of a reset once you get to kind of a catastrophe, that it takes a catastrophe to force the powers that be or compel the powers that be to kind of reset things in a more progressive in a more progressive fashion, whereby you can potentially have an economy that allows for much lower levels of income and wealth inequality. And I think, I would say that I probably agree with Piketty on that. I think if you look at what's been going on in the UK, for example, in recent times, in terms of kind of the cost of living crisis, growing levels of inequality and so on, I would say that everything that's happened since my book came out a couple of years ago seems to me to confirm the arguments that I developed in the book. I don't think you can understand what's been going on in terms of the cost of living crisis without reference to the extremely kind of rentier friendly nature of the UK's political economy. And I guess what you end up with is in this situation, and I think the cost of living crisis bears this out more than anything, which is that, instead of the old Keynesian argument of the state stepping in to through the welfare system to supplement the wage incomes of those who are underpaid by capital to enable them to buy the products and services created by firms, you kind of have a situation today where instead of, or at least as well as that, you have the state stepping in to enable households to pay rent of different forms to rentier interest because they're unable to do that, whether that's in the form of housing rent or whether that's in the form of their energy bills or whether that's in terms of transportation payments or something else. So the state, again, has become this kind of backstop to enable capitalism to kind of stagger onwards. It's just it's enabling different types of transfer payments or welfare payments today than it might have done in the past. And that's all about the transformation towards a more rentier type economy.
So if we play this out, I guess if we fail to acknowledge that these shifts have taken place and they're continuing to take place, and if we fail to make some sort of policy adjustment, should we expect to see a prolonged period of underemployment, high inflation, and perhaps a further hollowing out of the middle class?
I'm not sure about inflation. I'm not sure how that factors in here. Although one thing I would say there is that rentier interests, you know, they barely ever, it's not exactly like they need excuses to lift prices. But if a good excuse comes along, they will certainly exploit that excuse for all it's worth. And inflation obviously represents one such excuse. So inflation, you would think, would be a lever for working class interests to be able to increase to call for an increase in their wages. But of course, then when they ask for that, they get met by, you know, pleas or even demands for wage restraint and kind of scaremongering about wage price spirals and so on. But you know, rentier interest, in whether it's in the property sector or whether it's in the energy sector, tend not to be met by the same calls for restraint in terms of lifting housing rents, lifting energy prices, and so on. So that's what we see happening today. And so I think you know, if you get an inflation spiral, it tends to be on the capital side rather than on the labor side. But I wouldn't say much more about inflation, but certainly in terms of what you refer to as a hollowing out of the middle class, I think, which I kind of interpret more generally as growing levels of inequality, both in terms of income, but in particular in terms of wealth. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's impossible to see that trend reversing meaningfully while the existing rentier-friendly structures remain in place. I mean, I guess the only caveat you could say to that is you know, if you have falling asset prices, whether that's stock prices or whether it's property prices or both, then insofar as the wealthy have disproportionate exposure to those assets, then falling asset prices will actually reduce wealth inequality simply by virtue of the price effect. But if you assume that that's a short run phenomenon and that in the long term, or even in the medium term, asset prices will increase, then for sure, I would say existing levels of wealth inequality, which obviously are very, very high already, will continue to inflate.
So where should we go from here? I mean, we see the rentier profits are increasing. The percentage of profits dedicated to rentierism is increasing. More and more firms are investing resources into extraction rather than creation. What do you see as some of the remedies? Are there things that government can do to revert this trend? For instance, do we need capital endowments? Do we need to better enforce our antitrust laws? Do we need higher taxes on capital gains? I mean, all of the above. What are your prescriptions for saving capitalism from itself, but I guess doing so without throwing the proverbial baby out with the bathwater?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I have three answers to that. So one is all of the above. So I think, you know, for sure, you know, Piketty's point is that taxation has to be a big part of it. It's simply impossible to, in my view, and certainly in his view, to imagine things improving in a significant way, certainly vis-a-vis inequality, but also vis-a-vis kind of the structures of the economy in a place like the UK, while you have the existing taxation system, which is very, very soft on wealth and assets and disproportionately focused on income. And, you know, even many mainstream orthodox economists, you know, say the same thing. Much support for things like land value taxes, for example. But for what I imagine to be purely political reasons, calls for greater taxation of things like land and property more generally tend to fall on deaf ears. So taxation is part of it. Antitrust is certainly part of it. industrial policy, investment strategy of governments guiding investment to different parts of the economy can certainly be part of it. So that's the first part, is that yes, all of the above. I guess the second part of my answer would be to say yes, all those things, but probably the key thing I think has to be around ownership and, mm-hmm. and questions of ownership. The rentier capitalism is a form of capitalism where private property is the default model of ownership,
mm-hmm.
Both in absolute terms, but also in kind of developmental terms. So you privatize everything that can be privatized in a frontier economy like the UK's. And I think it's impossible to imagine in the UK case a healthier political economy while private property ownership remains the kind of default model for every type of asset imaginable. So I think that has to be part of it. You have to kind of get away from the idea that everything that is owned should be owned privately.
Right.
And then I think the third thing would be to say, it's just to raise a question, which is in kind of to your question rather than coming up with an answer, but which is to say, if you did all those things, does that amount to saving capitalism from itself? Or does it amount to actually kind of reforming capitalism and turning it into something that isn't quite capitalism as we know it? It might not be socialism, it may be socialism, but I think if you do all those things, then so many of those things are so integral to how we understand what capitalism actually is, that if you kind of pursue those things to their logical conclusion in relation particularly to things like ownership, then maybe what you end up with is not quite capitalism as we know it today.
Right. I mean, we don't like to think about widespread nationalization, but do you think that, until we are able to fashion a new economy that relies less on renterism and more on producing the goods that people need, which, that transition will take time, decades, presumably, that perhaps we should nationalize some sectors or begin breaking up some of the larger corporations so that we can increase market competitiveness?
Yeah, that's another good question. I think that... yes, I think that there are certain types of assets that would be excellent candidates for nationalization. To take one example, water and wastewater infrastructure delivery in the UK, for example. I see no good reasons why it was ever privatized and why it still is in private hands. So yes, maybe some assets could be nationalized, but I'm not sure that nationalization is always the right answer in terms of ownership transformation. Public ownership, if public ownership is the answer, which I think in many cases it is and should be, it doesn't necessarily have to be at a national level. It could be at a municipal level. So municipal ownership of certain types of assets, whether that's, again, waterworks,
right,
for example, might be one example there. So it doesn't have to be national. It could be municipal level, but still public ownership. And then the other question is, we often like to think in terms of kind of public ownership against private ownership, but they're not the only opportunities, right? So for example, in terms of something like land, another option is community ownership, which is neither public ownership nor private ownership as we typically understand of them. It's something else again. Employee ownership of firms, as some companies have been pushing in recent years, is again, that's not a nationalized industry, but neither is it a privately owned company. It's a company owned by its employees. And so again, I think there's a whole range of different ownership models, and that a healthier economy would be an economy where you had kind of a plural ecology of forms of ownership. Some types of assets, absolutely still best left off in private hands, maybe, but others best off in national ownership, others in municipal ownership, and others still under community or employee ownership. And and there's some excellent work being done by, various think tanks in countries like the UK now, which are really thinking pretty hard about different alternative ownership models and which type of ownership model is best suited to different types of assets.
Well, your book wasn't necessarily a call to action. It was a historical study and very, very great points made in the book. But if we were to sort of shepherd a transformation into a less rentier economy, who do you feel that we should call on to do so? Because whoever it is, they're certainly going to have to compete with the political power and large wallets of the multinational corporations and the landed wealthy that are going to do everything that they can to stop that. So who do you see as being the players and how do they get a seat at the table?
Well, I think that there are, that follows on really from where I finished the previous answer, which is to say that there are, plenty of, and you're right. So my book was long on diagnosis of problems and short on kind of development of ideas for changing the
that's a tough, if not impossible, problem to solve. I mean, your book did, and I think is something that really hasn't been addressed until your book came out, is that we have this problem, and here are the data, and here's the story. And so to ask you to solve that major problem, I mean, that's a whole another task. So,
But as I said, I think there are people out there doing this type of thinking, certainly in the UK and also in the US. It tends to be kind of smallish niche think tanks. There are obviously people, I think there are for sure, there are people working in and around the edges of left political parties in different countries doing this thinking, whether it's in relation to energy, whether it's in relation to housing, whether it's in relation to finance. There's lots of people doing this type of thinking, and lots of really, really smart people and persuasive people doing this thinking. The challenge, right, is that thinking is translating that thinking into tractable political action. And that's obviously where the big challenge is. And I think that the evidence of the last few years is not particularly encouraging in the sense, and I'm thinking particularly of the US and the UK, which are kind of the context I know best. I mean, you only need to think in relation to something like ideas around the Green New Deal, for example, which insofar as the Green New Deal is about infrastructure assets, development of green energy assets, and questions of ownership of those assets. It's fundamentally about, it might not always be expressed in these terms, but it's fundamentally about rentier interests controlling relevant infrastructures versus non-rentier interests, not least the state controlling these infrastructures. And while you kind of had initially, at least when these ideas were germinating, you had very progressive programs being developed by the likes of Bernie Sanders' team in the US and by Jeremy Corbyn's team in the UK. What ultimately happened is that both of those sort of initiatives petered out and got transformed into something very, very different, right, in the hands of Biden on the one hand and Keir Starmer in the UK on the other, where you might hear kind of nice noises about Green New Deal, but what they have in mind by Green New Deal is nothing like what Sanders and in particular Corbyn had in mind. And actually, if you read the manifesto that the Labour Party campaigned on under Corbyn in 2019, it was demonstrably an anti-rentier manifesto.
Right.
You know, if you want to think about it in those terms, and it's no coincidence that not just the right in both politics and the media kind of attacked Corbyn vehemently, but also the centre did, and it in many ways it was kind of the home owning pension relatively pension rich political and media centre that was most vehement in its opposition to Corbyn in the UK, which I think it goes back to the question you asked earlier about whether we're all rentiers now. Well, lots of people in the political centre are. Yeah. And when someone comes along like Corbyn, who really is thinking and talking about breaking the power of the rentier class, the rentier establishment, a lot of people get very, very frightened by that and very, very angry about that. And so I think there's some incredibly important lessons there that actually suggest that the prospects for things changing in those regards are very, very thin.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Professor, before we wrap up, I mean, this was an incredible chat. I do want to mention you have a new book coming out next year, Our Lives and Their Portfolios, Why Asset Managers Own the World. Excellent title. Very excited about it. Can you talk a little bit about what we can expect from it and perhaps any linkages it might have to what we discussed here today?
Sure. It's easy to answer that question, actually, because in many ways it comes directly out of the Rentier Capitalism book. You know, while I was doing that book and looking at ownership around the world of all these types, different types of rent generating assets, one thing that became very, very obvious is that asset managers, so asset management firms, the likes of BlackRock and Blackstone and others, that names that people will be very, very familiar with, crop up repeatedly when you're looking at who are the predominant owners of these types of assets. Very, very obvious on the financial asset side. You know, everyone knows that, you know, X percent of the average S&P company now is held by the big three index managers. That's been known for quite a long time now. It's very, very well researched. But what's less known is that it's not just financial assets that these types of companies own. They're also major, major owners of what the asset management industry refers to as quote unquote real assets, which is real estate, including housing, and also infrastructure of different forms, so telecommunications infrastructure, energy infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, and so on. So what that book is about is saying, okay, what more can we say specifically about asset managers as owners of these types of assets? You know, when did this start happening?
Right.
You know, what type of assets do they mainly own? Through what types of investment vehicle structures do they own them? Who's the money coming from? Is it just pension funds? Is it insurance companies? Is it sovereign wealth funds? You know, where this is happening most of all, but more than anything else, kind of what are the implications of this? What does it mean for society to be living in homes owned by Blackstone? What does it mean for society to be buying energy that's generated by wind farms owned by BlackRock? What does it mean for society to be traveling on public transport systems that are held under 99-year concessions by Macquarie, one of the world's biggest asset managers in this space? So absolutely it comes out of that, and it's about looking both at the cost of this, what are the costs to society of assets that, you know, in the past were often owned by the state, now being owned by asset managers, but kind of who gains from it? So who is making money out of this? Is it the ordinary pensioner, which if you listen to the asset management firms themselves, they will tell you that they're doing a good thing because it's, you know, the firefighter or the school worker with their pension who they're making money for, are the rewards of these investment funds being distributed in very, very different ways from that. So yes, it comes directly out of that book, but focuses on a very particular constituency and answers some very, very different types of questions.
Well, I very much look forward to it. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned a great deal from you, and we very much thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Thanks ever so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation greatly, and I feel it was a real privilege to talk to you, so thank you.
Well, that's it for us here at The Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with our very special guest, Brett Christophers. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.